bed. Now the boat won't float, I don't like it. I'm too proud to be poor. They used to call us working class, but we're just not working anymore. We're not a working, we're not a working. We're just not working anymore. They used to call us working class, but we're just
hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour, brought to you on air on listener-supported community radio station WFT, brought to you broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. So our program is brought to you in part by the Central Illinois Jobs with Justice, a coalition of union community groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at Channing Marine Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, visit www.centraliljwj.org at centraliljwj.org. And then there's a program, World Labor Hours, supported in part by the listeners of WFT and Decatur attorney Bill Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. And the World Labor Hour is supported in part by the listeners of WFT and by the FLCO Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of more than 7,000 workers in Champaign County and more than 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, AFL-CIO is proud to support community radio in East Central Illinois. And the Graduate Employees Organization Union, the GEO at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but also to give solidarity and support to other unions, organizations, and workers engaged in the struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour on WFT Community Radio. Okay, well, this is our last program of the year, because next week it'll already be the new year of 2016, and there's been a lot happening this year. I'm here with Angela today. Angela, how are you doing?
I'm okay. How about you,
Dave? Okay. So what did you think of 2015? I mean, I know, you know, that's when you first came on the air with us. I think it was back in the summer sometime in July or so, August. Mm-hmm. And I know there's a lot that's happened in your life this last year. Was it a good year, so-so year, bad year for you?
Both, but I mean, overall, you know, it worked out. You know, I mean, choices have been made, and mm-hmm. you know, I mean, just go with the flow. But it's been a lot going on, yeah. Mm-hmm. But you know what, my thing about that is, okay, I was in a little Arab store about 2-3 weeks ago, and like, there was a lot of people in there, and I'm from here.
Yeah,
I didn't know none of those people. I'm like, oh my goodness, where these people come from? So
yeah, that's part of being in a college town. I mean, you know,
it's a lot of people.
Always changes, you know. Yes. I mean, it's about probably about a fifth of our population is, you know, students, faculty, you know, professors, graduates, from all over the world, literally, But anyway, just some quick news stories here. The California port workers won a $6.9 million wage theft ruling, beginning of in for misclassification scheme. The California Labor Commission is ordering Pacific Nine Port Trucking Company to pay $6.9 million in stolen wages to 38 truck drivers. It's a landmark case ruling that these drivers were misclassified as quote-unquote independent contractors. Teamsters Port Trucker Campaign spokesperson Barb Maynard said, this is great news for port truck drivers who are misclassified, but it's more than that. It's a whole lot more than that. What we're starting to see here and what the Teamsters Union have really been taking on with this campaign is the beginning of the end of a scheme that is illegal. It is rife with tax fraud, and it's led to a degradation of work in America. And, you know, there's a lot of people out there that are forced to go into this, you know, independent contractor thing. And, you know, the problem with that is that then when they have no choice, but if they take a job having to be classified as independent contractors, that then the employer makes all the profits, but they're not on the line for any responsibility as far as paying workman's comp insurance, unemployment insurance, you know, Social Security, none of that. I mean, it's all the responsibility of this worker to pay double Social Security taxes, their own insurance, and everything. You know, it's just it's a scam. It should never have been allowed in the first place, because you know, it's just these people are workers, and everybody that's in that independent contractor thing is a worker, and they need to be treated as such, in the sense that you know, if the employer wants to have a business and make money, you know, then they need to you know, do right by the people that are actually making them the money. Well, there's been a lot going on around the country, you know, as far as Black Lives Matter. I guess they shut down the Mall of the America for a while up in Minneapolis, you know, and this is also going on, I see, in Chicago, where Michigan Avenue was shut down on Christmas Eve, and also out in Los Angeles, and some other cities around the country. And, you know, it's just interesting, because we've talked a lot about this on the program during the course of this last year, and it's just really disgusting. That's the best word I can find for it. It's disgusting that there's been so many police officers in this country that have been allowed to literally get away with murder. And I don't use that word lightly. As far as I'm concerned, anybody who kills another human being other than self-defense, another human being unarmed, that's murder. I'm not going to slice it any. You can't slice it any other way. It's murder.
It is.
And there's been an epidemic of this going on. And you thought, you know, back a year and a half ago when Michael Brown was murdered by that cop Darren Wilson in Ferguson, Missouri, you'd have thought that all the community had to come out to get any just a semblance of justice, even even though that cop's still not in jail. You know, the U.S. Justice Department got involved, but very, very little was actually done, you know, to rectify that. And I thought that after that, all that, that you were going to see, you know, U.S. Justice Department clamping down on police departments, actually seeing prosecutions, and that the police themselves would kind of back off on this stuff, but I've seen just the opposite here in the last year and a half. I see more police murders.
Yeah, even the Sandra Bland case.
Oh my God, that, you know what? I'm glad you mentioned that, because of all these horrific cases, that has to be the worst. I mean, you're going to tell me that this woman who had, she's originally from Chicago, I believe, yeah. And she went to school down in Texas, I think Texas A&M, and she moved back to Chicago and she got a pretty decent job down there, and that's where she was heading to when she got pulled over by that cop, and just because she was basically pretty much questioning his authority and sticking right up for her rights, you know, he beats the hell out of her, and then they throw her in a jail cell, and supposedly this woman commits suicide with a trash bag.
Right.
Give me a break. And they let him go. They had an investigation. They said that there was no evidence to show that anything but a suicide happened. I mean,
you know,
give me a break.
They all work together, though. I mean, they're not going to tell on themselves. So only the best solution is a lawsuit, a settlement. Okay, but that's not going to bring your family member back.
Right. And you see, even here locally, with this recent Champaign police officer, Matt Rush, I believe his name is, who has not just one instance, but I mean multiple instances of beating up on people. In fact, the last guy, I guess the city of Champaign had to pay out $225,000 as a settlement. And I just found out last week, a friend of mine happened to be the one who videotaped it. It happened right next door to where he lived. Mm-hmm. And he went out and saw what was going on, and he's got a cell phone and filmed the whole thing, and I guess that was what was kind of the crucial thing. And but you know, here's the thing. Anthony Cobb, the Champaign chief of police, who was a huge improvement over the previous chief of police, Finney, who, remember when Finney was the chief of police, Kewan Carrington, a 15-year-old African-American kid, was shot dead by Chief, well, anyway, that's kind of in dispute, but anyway, Chief Finney, another officer, was there, report, you know, supposedly they got a call that someone was trying to break into a house, and it turns out, Kewan Carrington was trying to get into his own house. He locked himself out, you know, and he ended up dead, you know. I mean, it's a 15-year-old, he was unarmed, he tried to get into his own house, and he ends up dead, you know, shot point blank in the chest. Point blank. I mean, I guess the evidence showed that the gun was like within an inch or two of his chest.
So that was a close range.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, and I don't know how much money the city of Champaign had to pay out on that case. But anyway, I'm getting at is, you know, Finney left, and this Anthony Cobb, who used to be an African-American man who was a police officer at the city of Urbana Police Department for many years, became the Champaign Chief of Police and started to make some changes. And he actually fired this guy, this Matt Rush. Mm-hmm. And then the Policeman's Union gets his job back for him. I mean, this is ridiculous. I mean, it's like Bill and I were joking, I think it was a couple shows ago, boy, I wish we had that kind of representation in the building trades.
Sure.
I mean, we'd get, you know, fired and our union wouldn't do anything if we were, like, say, maybe 2 minutes late or something one morning or something if the boss didn't happen to like you. So, I mean, here's a person who's obviously out of control, that can't control himself, doesn't know, you know, that actually, you know, can't restrain himself from using violence against unarmed people. I mean, this person doesn't need to be a police officer.
I think he's overusing, you know, some people get that authority, get a little authority, and they take it too far.
You know, there's been lots of psychological studies done on this sort of thing. And, you know, that's the thing is, you know, the police need to do psychological evaluations of anybody they're going to hire for a police officer. But, you know, that's not, you know, that needs to be part of it. But I think it's like we talked before, is really the solution is an elected civilian police review board, in which the people elect a 3 or 5 member board in their city where they live to basically handle complaints of excessive violence and that's done by the police and everything. And, you know, of course, the police are fighting this tooth and nail, you know. They're fighting a tooth and nail. And, you know, it's amazing because you think that good police officers, and there's many good police officers out there, let's, you know, I will say that. I mean, unfortunately, it's these cases of these police officers that are basically don't have no business being and with that kind of authority, you know.
Then, like you said, the psychological part about it, you don't know what they've been through. Okay, I'm having a bad life, that everything's not going right, I just, well, let me go and get a police job. Then I can harass people that way, and I can do it legitimately. So, but the police are the only ones that can kill you and nothing happens. But if we kill each other, then we have consequences.
Well, indeed, as we should, you know, I mean, like I said, I mean, there's only, as far as I'm concerned, that's why I oppose the death penalty too, is that I firmly believe that, you know, the only time another human has the right to kill another human being is in defense of their own life or the life of their, you know, family, you know. There's no other reason. I mean, there's no other justifiable reason to kill another human being. But, you know, what's interesting is that, you kind of touched on another subject here is, as far as, you know, people that have become police officers. It seems like police departments in the last 10 years or so have been heavily recruiting from, former military people, you know, veterans that come home. And I think, like anyone else, I mean, you know, veterans, when they, you know, go through all that crap, especially, you know, what's been going on in the last 14 years or so with these, you know, wars of aggression in Afghanistan and Iraq and elsewhere, that they need to be taken care of. I mean, they put their life on the line. Even though I disagree with the policy, I still feel for these people, young men and women. And, you know, they come home and of course they need to, you know, be able to get jobs and stuff. But the problem is it seems like they're heavily recruiting from people that have been in war zones, that were basically an occupying army, because that's what the U.S. military is in Afghanistan, in Iraq, was in Iraq, was basically they invaded the country and they're basically the occupiers. And people who resist either, you know, nonviolently or violently, they're going to kill them or arrest them and end up in this torture prison like Abu Ghraib. And that's another thing. A lot of these people that were, the small fish, if you will, who got convicted in the Abu Ghraib prison torture scandal, nobody, no officer or anyone higher up in the Bush administration was even touched by this. And you know that's where all this came from originally.
Definitely.
But these people, all of them, these privates and corporals and sergeants that were convicted, it's interesting because most of them worked as prison guards before they got in the military.
Oh, wow.
You know, so I mean, it's a vicious cycle. This violent.
That's the worst kind.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, we're going to see what happens in 2016, but what's really good, I mean, it's too bad it has to come to this, but you know, when a country is not respecting the wishes of the people, that's when the people need to get out in the streets and shut things down. I mean, because that's something the ruling class in this country really take notice of, is when you start interrupting their flow of cash, you know,
sure,
and business as usual, man, you know. So, but anyway, I'm going to play take a little music break here, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on the Supported Community Radio Station, WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back.
For the polls are over. burial is too expensive. Is there a casket to be rented? Bury me like a mummy when I die. The people want to change. Tired of the same old thing.
Okay, we're back. That was John Lee Hooker with People Want to Change. And all, you know, I tell you what, just thinking back on the year 2015 and recent events here just in the last week or so, I thought that'd be a very appropriate song because it's definitely the case. People, you know, we got a situation in our country when you look at poll after poll after poll on different issues, whether it's, you know, healthcare, Medicare for all, whether it's, you know, ending these wars, you know, abroad and spending more money on human needs here in this country, you know, on and on and on. I mean, every single poll you show that the politicians are doing just the opposite of what the majority of the people want in this country. So that should tell you that we've come to a crisis point where the people that we elect, this remnant that we have left of a democracy are not listening to us. They don't care about us, that we're more concerned, with the people who give them money, the, you know, corporate special interests. So anyway, by the way, I want to let the listeners know that, we've got a special 90-minute program today. We've got two callers calling in, one at 11:30, Sarah Morkin from the, Tacoma $15 an hour minimum wage campaign. She's going to be talking about their recent campaign. And at 12 noon, we're going to be having Paul Simons call in, who's part of the, Rojava Syria, Solidarity Network, talking about, what's been going on in, northern Syria, with, quite an interesting little light of hope, if you will, within the chaos of the Middle East that's going on. But also, tune in today at 1 p.m. for WFT Vision 2000 Radio with Sandra Alton. Sandra, who's part of the Board of Directors Rapid Response Team, will be discussing the future of WFT, including discussion of plans for creating more news and public affairs program. And joining her will be Chris Evans. There'll be discussions about creating the new budget and the deficit to be met, and the upcoming listener survey will be conducted beginning in February. So that's today at 1 p.m. Here on WFT 90.1 FM and at WEFT.org. And just to let you know that today and every Saturday at 2 p.m., tune in for Done Another Sports Show with fellow worker Neil Parthen, which is on WRFU 104.5, and also on the internet at www.wrfu.org. And also on Sundays at 4 to 5 p.m., tune in to Labor's Worldview TV. With the host, yours truly, with various labor video and interviews, and you can tune in that at Comcast Channel 6 and on the internet at UrbanaPublicTelevision.org. So, yes, I'm here with Angela. Gus is down in Atlanta visiting family. Bob Plesney is in Chicago visiting his elderly mother and father. And Bill Gorell, I guess, was working out in the rain digging ditches or something. And he called me and said he's going to be on his way here and everything. So I'm here with Angela Bingham. And I don't know. We'll talk about maybe a little bit about what's happened this last year. There's been so much going on, it's almost like a blur. I mean, you know, trying to kind of think about what's happened here in the last year. I mean, it's been a pretty eventful year, and it's, I was going to make a list here today of kind of the highlights of this last year, but I'm thinking about maybe waiting until next program, even though it'll be January 2nd, to kind of maybe talk about that. Since Angela joined us here back in the summer, there's been a lot of interesting discussions. We try to bring everybody who tunes into this program kind of a little bit of what's going on, not just nationally, but also internationally, and also locally too, because what's happening in our community, that's a working issue. I mean, that's what we do here. We don't want to just talk about unions. We want to talk about issues that affect working people, which is you think about it, that's quite a broad category. I mean, because talking about what's going on in the community as far as, police brutality, as far as, what's going on internationally with foreign policy. I mean that, this all affects working people, directly or indirectly. And that's why we feel that it's important to talk about these issues and stuff. It's interesting that, besides that song, People Want to Change, there's been a lot of other, lots of different, people have written articles about what's been going on the last couple of years. This one I just saw on the internet today, The Revolt of the Anxious Class is the title of it. It's at HuffingtonPost.com. It's by Robert Reich. who used to be the Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration, which is interesting about him is that he resigned shortly into Bill Clinton's second term because he just didn't feel like the Clinton administration was really serious about workers' rights. Interesting, he wrote a book about it, and it's kind of interesting. I never read the whole book, but I did, you know, go through, kind of skim through it and read certain parts of certain chapters, and it's quite interesting. But anyway, he, this recent article he wrote, it is just basically about how it's becoming harder, more and more difficult for people to keep their heads above water economically. I mean, even people that you know, have decent paying jobs or had decent paying jobs, and that's a growing category of people that had decent paying jobs and then lost them and have to end up working for minimum wage, is that, you know, this, what they call the middle class, has been shrinking. You know, people with middle class incomes, the number of those have been shrinking and shrinking. I mean, this has been going on for about the last 20 years or more, but it's accelerated here just in the last few years. And they said that according to what he's writing here, he said two-thirds of Americans, working Americans, are living paycheck to paycheck, meaning that if they lost their jobs, that losing that first paycheck or so, first couple paychecks would just be devastating for them. And, you know, many are these workers that do lose decent jobs are becoming part of the growing workforce called on-demand workforce, basically employed as needed, paid whatever they can get, whenever they can get it. And if they don't keep up with their rent or mortgage payments or can't pay for grocery utilities, they'll lose their footing. And it's, the stress is taking its toll, you know. And for the first time in the last maybe, you know, 70 years or so, the average lifespan of Americans in this country is starting to decline. I mean, instead of all this improvement with, you know, medical technology and stuff, our lifespans are actually beginning to decline. And what's really interesting, they say the lifespans in particular of middle-class white people. I mean, this is interesting. I mean, the fact that, you know, I mean, you know, I've seen for years the statistics, you know, as far as you know, disparities, you know, between income, between race, as far as, like, say, infant mortality, as far as, you know, what's the term for it? There's a term for when, you know, the mortality rate of mothers, you know, who give birth, who die in childbirth or whatever. And life expectancy in general has been, you know, lower for African Americans in general.
Yeah, that's, you know, because a big part of it is, like you said, keeping your head above water. And when you can't do that, it stresses you out. And stress is a killer itself.
Yes.
You can't do for yourself. You can't provide for your family. Now you're worrying. And then, I mean, I'm just saying, who helps? I mean, I don't see any improvement with our government. So, like me, I'm not voting this year because I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know their credentials. I don't know. I just, I mean, you just don't trust nobody these days.
You know, Angela, I hope to talk you out of that before voting comes, but I don't, I understand why you feel that way, because you know what? People, your opinion is actually, you're the majority right now in this country. The last election in 2014, 61% of the American people who were eligible to vote chose not to vote. And that's why. That's exactly why, of all the different surveys and polls and interviews I've seen that they did with people, you know, like after that 2014 election, they're saying the same things you said right now.
Because, I mean, we're not, I don't see any progress. I don't see that from last year till for this year. Okay, I don't see any change.
Yeah.
So
except for the worst, it seems like at times.
Right. And so what are we voting for? And what's going to change? This is my question.
Yes, indeed. Yes, and you know, that's the thing, is that, you know, the fact of the matter is that over time, corporate money has become more and more infused, if you will, into the whole you know, the whole electoral thing. I mean, you know, not so much the local level, not on the local level really, unless you live in this large city like Chicago or somewhere. Little bit the state level, but I mean, when you run for national office, either U.S. Congressperson, U.S. Senator, or President of the United States, you know, corporate money, is just, you know, it finances both political parties. It's not just the Republicans, it's also the Democrats. And, this, you know, they have an old saying, he who pays the piper, calls the tune, you know, basically, you know, when they take this money from these people, I mean, you know, if they take their money and don't do what they want, they're gonna face some serious, problems the next election. Okay, I think our caller is calling in here. Hello, WFT, you're on the air.
Hi, David. This is Sarah Morkin from 15 Now Tacoma.
Hi, Sarah. How you doing? Okay, I just want to let everybody know that, you know, listeners out there, that we had Sarah call in back, and I think it was, what was it, September or so?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah, a few months ago. And you want to tell us what you and some of your, you know, fellow workers out there were doing at that time in regards to the $15 an hour minimum wage?
When we spoke last, we were right at the beginning of the doorbelling campaign to get out the vote for Initiative 1, which was a citizen's initiative to raise the minimum wage in the city of Tacoma to $15 an hour for all the workers at the large businesses.
Okay, and tell us how that went. I mean, from what you were telling us last time, was that you guys were going door to door, getting signatures and that, and that during the course of this campaign, you actually, you know, had some opposition from the usual suspects you expected, like the Chamber of Commerce and other business interests. But then you had some other opposition from some surprising source. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Right about the time that we had enough signatures to get our initiative on the ballot, we were contacted by the Downtown Business Association and the Chamber of Commerce, and they asked us to withdraw the initiative, and we said no. And then around that same time, the Secretary Treasurer of the SEIU 775, which represents mainly home care workers who make about, on average, about $12 an hour, and also the political director of UFCW 21, which represents primarily grocery store workers who, I mean, their contract specifies that they get at least 10 cents above minimum wage.
10 cents above minimum wage. Wow, boy, those are some hard negotiators there with United Food and Commercial Workers.
Right. And 21 is actually my union. I work in healthcare. They also represent a significant number of healthcare workers, too. But those two people came to, they reached out to the campaign. They actually had one of our liberal city council members reach out to us and ask to meet with us. And they basically said, you guys are going to lose and we want you to withdraw the initiative because you're going to lose and you're going to ruin the movement for, increasing the minimum wage.
Really? And,
yeah, they said, we're not going to support you. You don't have enough support. In addition to them, Socialist Alternative, asked us to withdraw the initiative too because they said the same thing that the unions, the big unions did. They said, you're gonna lose and you're gonna ruin the movement. But I think that their reason for, their primary reason for asking us to withdraw the initiative and it was because they didn't want to support it. They didn't want to have to come out and support it because Thomas DeWant's city council campaign got a lot of funding from SEIU 775 and UFCW 21.
Oh, man. I mean, this is really disturbing. I wasn't aware. You know, I know last time you called in, you had talked about a little bit about getting some opposition from, surprisingly, from United Food and Commercial Workers and SEIU. But this was, you know, Shama Sawant and Socialist Alternative. I mean, that was one of her keystone campaign issues was the $15 an hour minimum wage. And the fact that, you know, I'm just trying to kind of, I'm sort of just, digesting this here, as I'm talking. But, you know, first of all, the whole thing about supposedly when you try with a, something, you know, in this case a ballot initiative, to push for an increase in wages, how that can be in and of itself, you know, counterproductive, if you will. I mean, when you're in a negotiation, let's say, whether you're a union negotiator, negotiating the higher wages, or say you're buying a used car. I mean, you always, you know, if you want to try to get the best deal, so to speak, and be a good negotiator, you always, you know, start high and then, you know, and try to stay as, you know, as firm as you can. And if you have to maybe compromise a little bit and go down, that'd be one thing, you know. But I mean, just to start off in the starting get saying, oh, you know, don't even try. And, and if you try, it's going to make it worse. I mean, that's just ridiculous.
Yeah, that's a very weak position to take. And, I mean, obviously the Chamber of Commerce was, they were concerned that we were going to win because they contacted the mayor and asked her to put a competing ballot initiative on the ballot.
A competing ballot initiative. Okay. And what was that that they put on?
After the Chamber of Commerce realized we weren't going to withdraw the initiative, and after the unions, the big unions, we did get union support, but some of the biggest unions didn't support us. But after they realized that we were going to go ahead with it, the Chamber of Commerce contacted the mayor and said, please raise the minimum wage. So we forced the Chamber of Commerce to ask for a minimum wage raise, but they said the 15 now campaign, they're too extreme, they're going to destroy the economy, and so we want you to put another ballot initiative on the ballot that'll raise the minimum wage in a more reasonable way. And so the mayor jumped right to attention. Now, mind you, she didn't pay any attention to us when we went to city council last year in October. But nonetheless, she jumped right to work and organized a minimum wage task force there were, I think, about 17 people on the minimum wage task force. Two of them were alternates. And there were several people from unions, no union members. They were all union staffers.
Uh-huh.
There was someone from the faith community. There were business owners. There were nonprofit directors. And they met for 2 months, and they got input from the University of Washington Tacoma Economics Department and statistics and stuff to help them inform their decisions. And they ended up putting forth two proposals. They couldn't come to an agreement on one different proposal, so there was the majority proposal, which would have raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2019.
Okay.
And then there was the business proposal, which was the minority proposal, and they wanted to raise the minimum wage to, I think, $12 or $13 an hour within a few years.
How much was the minimum wage? During when this was going on, was it like around $8 an hour or so?
In Washington State, the minimum wage is $9.47 an hour.
$9.47. Okay.
Yeah, and by the way, it was not even scheduled to go up in 2016 because the state decided that the cost of living hadn't gone up enough, so we weren't even going to get a COLA adjustment to the minimum wage. But anyway, so there were two proposals came out of that task force, and city council decided to go with the minority proposal from business.
Mm-hmm.
And they modified it a little bit, and the initiative that ended up going on the ballot to compete with ours was $12 an hour within 2 years.
Okay.
So basically a 27% increase within 2 years.
Okay, and then so what happened on Election Day? Did you guys win or did they win?
They won.
Okay.
And part of the problem was, and this sounds really wacky, but when two ballot initiatives that are covering the same issue are on the same ballot, the way, in our state, the way the ballot has to read is, first, there's a question that says, well, in our case, do you favor increasing the minimum wage, yes or no? And then there's another question after that that says, regardless of how you answered, that first question, which one of these would you choose? Ours was Initiative 1, and theirs was Initiative 1B.
Okay.
So basically, even people that voted no, the minimum wage should not increase, they got to choose. So basically, all the no, and that's what the Chamber of Commerce was recommending people do. They said that vote no on the first question, and then vote Initiative 1B on the second question.
Okay.
So 1B got all the no votes, and some of the more timid yes votes.
Okay.
So they ended up getting 72% of the vote, and we got 28% of the vote.
Okay. Well, I mean, wow. I mean,
and
that's still...
They spent like $112,000. $110,000, and we spent $8,000.
$112,000 on their side, they spent $8,000 you guys spent. Okay.
Yeah, see, it's organized people beat organized money.
Well,
right?
No, they lost. However, did they really lose? Because here's the thing. You know, even though your ballot initiative lost, if you guys hadn't initiated in the first place, there wouldn't have been the $12 an hour or something, which came out, like you said, to a 27% wage increase for the minimum wage. I mean, man, I don't know of any union contracts in recent history that have gotten that big of a percentage increase for their members.
David, you're absolutely right. And unions have way more resources than we do. They have lawyers, paid staff, office space, all kinds of things that we didn't have. And so we consider it a partial victory. And, you know, of course we were disappointed. We would have liked to at least had a better showing.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to our lack of resources and the opposition, it was an off year, and voting participation was like super low. It was like record low.
Mm-hmm. I think you guys did a heck of a job. I mean, considering this was totally, grassroots, real grassroots here. I mean, you know, like you were saying before, this was nothing sponsored by a union or a nonprofit. This was just a bunch of workers that got together and started going door to door. I mean, you know, this is an incredible story. And that's why I wanted you not only call in back in September, but of course calling in today too, you know, as a follow up, because I think more people need to start doing this around the country. Unfortunately, here in Illinois, not only do we have the worst ballot access laws in the country as far as a non-Democrat or Republican political party being able to get on the ballot, but we have voter ballot initiatives, but they're non-binding. In other words, they're just suggestions.
Like the one in the last election that to raise the minimum wage.
Which hasn't been raised yet.
Yeah, and also legalized marijuana, and that passed, but it was just an advisory one. And still, Rahner got elected.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, our Republican governor. Because the Democrat he was running against was a corporate Democrat, and there wasn't much difference between the two of them, really. Except, Rahner was a little more extreme. But yeah, this is what we've come to in this country, it seems, is that, you know, it seems like, you know, we're aware of, and expect resistance from the corporate sector, but man, when we start running into resistance from unions and nonprofits that are supposed to be, you know, serving people.
Dave, I think it's similar to health care. Look how long unions opposed any sort of
single payer
health care, because that takes away something that the union can get for you.
Yeah.
And it might be easier to get some benefits like that than it is to get a raise.
Yeah. Well, of course, that's come back to bite them now with this whole Cadillac tax that's going to be coming down the tubes with Obamacare. But that's another subject for another topic for another program. But anyway, I think this is incredible, Sarah, and I just wanted to share this story with you. And I think we got to try to get your story out there. I think more people around the country and stuff, because
Dave,
I think this is a real inspiration.
I believe I heard Sarah on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox recently.
No kidding. You were on Cindy Sheehan's program?
Yeah. A friend of mine reached out to Cindy and asked her if she would interview me, and and she did, and it was great. I've been a fan of Cindy since back in the Camp Casey days when she
camped out on George Bush's front lawn, more or less.
God, yeah, she's a very cool person, funny too, and I just want to remind people that you can get this show. You can get Cindy Sheehan's show, and you can get a whole bunch of other really cool podcasts and radio shows at radioforall.net. And that's radio the digit for A-L-L Net.
Okay, thanks for that, Bill. Well, hey, Sarah, cool. Is there anything else you wanted to leave the, you know, let the listeners hear about? We're starting to kind of run out of time here.
Yeah, well, for people that are in the Puget Sound area, 15 Now Tacoma is having another meeting to kind of figure out where do we go from here, what, you know, what do we want to do next, if anything. On January 6th at the Tacoma Public Library at 6:30 p.m., the Tacoma Public Library downtown. And if people want to kind of keep updated on what's going on with us, we have a Facebook page, 15 Now Tacoma, and a website, 15nowtacoma.info.
Okay, Sarah, thank you so much for calling in, and I'm just hoping, you know, we get your word out what you guys did, the great job you guys have done in Tacoma and the rest of the country, because I think this needs to be emulated all over the place. You know, I guess since our elected officials aren't doing, you know, representing us, and it seems like not all, but a lot of unions out there aren't representing their members like they could be. I think it's just time that, you know, working people took, you know, things into their own hands, and you guys are a great example of that. So it's a real honor to have you call in, and thank you so much.
Thank you, David. I sure appreciate you helping us get the word out.
You bet. Take care.
Happy holidays.
Yes, happy holidays. Take care.
Bye.
But my dream, it lingered near in the farmer, shining valleys where the pure air recognized. Oh, and my senses newly open, but I waking up into the cry that the people have the power to redeem the work of fools from the meek, the grace to shower. The farmer, shining valleys.
Okay, that was Patti Smith, People Have the Power. And we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on List Supported Community Radio Station, WFT, broadcasting from downtown Champaign, Illinois. Bill Gorrell's joined us. I guess he was out playing in the rain here earlier and got to the station finally here. And Bill, so what's been going on? I mean, you know, Angela and I were talking earlier about, you know, 2015, this last year it's closing. This is going to be the last program in the year 2015. It's been quite an eventful year. Anything that's kind of grabbed you about this year?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. My favorite thing's been what many people refer to as the clown car.
The clown car?
That I'll also call the freak show, and that is this Republican presidential campaign, primary
campaign. It was that way last time, too, if I remember, with the exception of Ron Paul, which, I mean, I got some differences with him on Social Security and Medicare, but pretty principled.
Paul, you've been hanging around with Carl too much.
No, okay. Listen. I'm just calling it how I
inside
see it.
Inside baseball.
I'm calling
folks,
how sorry. I see it as far as, you know, being anti-war, anti-corporate trade treaties, and pro-civil liberties.
Yeah.
I have to agree with them, and I
have
to say.
Well, pro-civil liberties, but not so much civil rights.
That kind of became revealed later on. But I'm saying is, at least he's got some principles. Unlike the rest of them, is what I'm trying to get at here.
Well, he doesn't stand up for his racism. He pretty well kept that hidden, even though it was in these newsletters that people were buying from.
Anyway,
that were probably, you know.
I don't want to get off on that.
Well, but it's a typical Republican grifter thing.
Yeah.
Okay, these guys, Huckabee, he's wanting to sell a book and get a show. I mean, they wanted to sell books. That's Ben Carson. He dropped out of the race for a while, stopped campaigning for president to be on his book tour.
Yeah.
Which is also, I think, campaigning for president. I didn't see the distinction.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, really, that is one thing about Donald Trump. He's pretty serious, I guess.
Well,
even
I
though
think
as
he's
weird
an egotistical
he is,
clown.
Frankly. He is an egotistical clown, but he's real serious about it.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know. And then we got Hillary Clinton on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you talk about the poster child for corporate America and the American oligarchy.
Dave, I'll tell you right now, the mirror image of Ron Paul in many ways is Bernie Sanders. Bernie's great on all the domestic stuff, and he's really stepped up on civil rights.
Yes.
And I think he's probably pretty good on civil liberties. But foreign policy?
I know.
No.
I know. That's the thing. That is his big weakness, and Hillary Clinton actually used it against him in the last debate when he was criticizing her for her vote on invasion of Iraq and what she did to Libya as the Secretary of State. She came back and said, Bernie, you voted for the, you know, the military action in Libya. And what could he say?
Yeah,
you know?
Pot meet kettle.
Yeah, indeed. But like you said, on the domestic issues, Bernie Sanders is not just talking. He's got like a 20-some year track record to show. He's been a consistent advocate of Medicare single payer for all, for free college tuition for everybody, as far as living wages for everybody, and with the you know, the civil rights thing. I mean, he was involved. He was down south with the Freedom Riders back when he was a young man, and he's come out several times and commented about, you know, how Sandra Bland, for instance, he said that if she'd have been a white woman, she probably would have been alive today. And this whole thing of racism and law enforcement is an issue that has to be dealt with. So yeah, we can give him lots of, but you know, that's the real sad thing.
Well, she was a real twofer, man. She had an out-of-state plate. That's the first thing that attracts attention to a lot of these cops.
When you're down south.
Out-of-state, well, in Illinois.
Yeah.
In southern Illinois, in
fact.
Mm-hmm. And then he's like, oh boy, I also get a black woman too, you know, that I can harass.
Yeah.
You know, man.
Like we said earlier, the psychological part of that.
And he was a state trooper. And usually the state cops are the cream of the crop in law enforcement in that state.
In any state, pretty much.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that says a lot. But, yeah. And so, okay. So the, this, dog and pony show that we call American Politics, with some exceptions out there. And
there's nothing come up. Like, as, for example, in, these debates and stuff, you hardly ever hear anything about climate change, labor issues. What? Labor issues. But boy, they talk middle class.
Oh yeah. And ICs, you know, military, you know, the you know, be afraid.
MICs. Oh, okay.
Be afraid. Be
M-I-C-K-E-Y.
Very afraid.
Yeah.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. Let us take away more of your civil liberties so we'll protect you, you know.
Yes. And
you know, that's to keep us occupied.
Exactly. Exactly.
They want us to know what's really going on.
You know, if you ever go to another country and watch their media, I mean, you know, If you understand a little bit of language or it happens to be in English, it's amazing the difference in U.S. News programs and in other countries. I mean, it's just incredible difference. I mean, here it's like one distraction after another. I mean, you know, what's Justin Bieber doing these days? And oh, yes, what about the Kardashians and what's his name having a sex change operation?
Right,
and
a cat. Track.
Yes, and a cat caught up in a tree in Tupelo,
Dave,
Mississippi.
Dave, trending now on Yahoo, just because it's handy for me to get to this. Number one, Khloe Kardashian. Number two, Miss Universe. Does Miss Universe, was that is that Trump's?
I don't know.
Okay. Rocco Ritchie.
Who in the heck's Rocco Ritchie?
I have no idea.
Okay.
Okay, now here's one I understand. Oil prices.
Okay.
Five, causes of cancer. All right. Six, after Christmas sales. Seven, Cam Newton.
Cam Newton.
I have no idea who that is. Judge Judy's number eight. Number nine is Boxing Day. That's just curious people, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And 10 is Lexus NX.
Which is?
A car.
Oh.
A luxury car, in fact, Dave.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So, and in holiday searches, yoga mats is number two. That's good, I think. But,
But
Khloe Kardashian, usually on here, at least the first five and usually up to the first seven are exotic sounding names of young women who are either athletes, singers, or actresses, or actors, I guess.
Uh-huh.
We don't say actress anymore. So actually it's pretty impressive this week that, you know, you got cancer and oil prices in the top five.
That's impressive. You know, I mean, wow. Okay, looks like our other caller is calling in here. So, hello, WFT, you're on the air?
Yeah, this is Paul Simons calling.
Hi, Paul, how you doing?
Very good, how are you?
Thank you so much for this Saturday. I know there was a little miscommunication last Saturday and stuff, but I know a lot of people have been really looking forward to hearing you, you know, calling in and everything. So why don't you just start out by introducing yourself?
Okay, I'm Paul Z. Simons. That's the name that I've been writing under since the 80s, and involved in the anarchist movement in the U.S. Currently am the editor, or co-editor, actually, of a journal that comes out, a rather larger journal called Modern Slavery, which is more theoretical type of stuff, although we do some journalism as well, some history, that type of thing. Just have been, you know, writing, posting stuff on the internet regarding Rojava before leaving for it, and then went there in October and spent 9 or 10 days in Rojava after crawling across the border.
Okay, yeah. So
back.
Rojava is in north. That'd be north eastern Syria.
Correct. It's a thin strip, probably maybe 150 kilometers wide, that just parallels the Turkish border in Syria, and then it abuts on one side the it abuts Syria or Turkey on one side, and then it abuts Iraq on the Tigris River on the other.
Okay, and this is primarily predominantly a Kurdish area, correct?
It is. There are a number of populations there, some Kurdish, some ethnically Kurdish, some not. So just there's Arab populations there. There is one of the oldest Christian communities in the world there, the Assyriacs, the Assyrians. And then there are Syrians per se, which is taken to be a different ethnicity. And there are a number of languages spoken there, including Kurmanji, which is the dialect of Kurdish that's spoken there. Arabic, of course, and
mm-hmm.
And then Syriac, which is the Christian language.
Okay, so you have Christians and Muslims together in that area too, as well as the other ethnic groups.
Right, and then within the Kurdish ethnic population, you have there's a few Christians, very small population of Christians,
mm-hmm.
mostly Sunni Muslims, and then there's Yazidis, and Yazidism is a very ancient religion. It may even predate Zoroastrianism. It's kind of, you know, dark and white fighting each other, very Manichaean.
Okay, so you got an ethnic and religious mix here in this area, and yet you know, it's interesting because I didn't even know what was going on there. I don't think most people did until about a year ago. And of course, I got this off the internet when there was an article. I can't remember who posted it or anything, but it showed these women in Syria with assault rifles and in somewhat. Some type of, you know, sort of military uniforms, and talking about how they had been, you know, they were mainly responsible for fighting off the ISIL the city of Kobani, and that they would successfully fought them off. And it's like, wow, what the heck? And then it started talking about how they created this sort of society within this this area of turmoil in the Middle East, to which it was very democratic, very secular, and also involved women in all levels, including administrative and even military commanders. It was just quite interesting. And I know since then, the corporate media, New York Times and The Guardian, have kind of picked up on this and everything. And, but this has been going on for a while. Is that correct?
I mean, the story really begins in 1978 with a group of Kurdish students sitting around and deciding that they're going to try to militarily form a nation called Kurdistan. And one of them, Abdullah Öcalan, who is kind of the main thinker of the group, embarked on a path of Marxism-Leninism until 1999. He was eventually captured by the Turkish Secret Service, assisted by the CIA and the Mossad, and is currently jailed, for the rest of his life in Turkey. But his ideas, while in jail, he got a chance to sit and read, and he picked up the works of kind of an important anarchist thinker in the U.S. called Murray Bookchin, as well as Foucault and a number of other thinkers, Jean Proudhon, the one of the first anarchist thinkers in France, and he completely rejected Marxism and just basically said, this is not where we're going. It doesn't affect the class struggle is not really what we're talking about here. We're really talking about fundamentally an idea of changing society, and we want to bring everybody with us. And so he started contemplating how to do that and came up with what he called democratic confederalism, which is, if people are interested, it's a pamphlet. It's about a 90-page pamphlet. It's available on the internet. It's a real fast read, and it just kind of lays out his ideas. But his ideas are fundamentally this. They believe that the nation state is a weapon, and that they don't want to use that weapon to abuse anybody. So, and that, of course, mirrors both Marx and Bakunin. I mean, he's not saying anything new. So there is no nation state in Rojava, by way of example, the way that we understand the nation state, which is a monopoly of force over a geographical area. Women's empowerment, I think there's a Kurdish resonance there, and then there's a Western resonance. The Kurdish resonance, I think, is much deeper, so that the empowerment of women goes a lot more to the core of Kurdish society and I think Middle East society than what we would imagine. By way of example, obviously, if you don't have a government, you need people talking to each other, and people talk to each other in the context of small groups, communes, councils, and then larger groups, executive councils, and things like that. Women are required to represent 40% of any given council or any given executive council. In addition, on these councils, there are two co-chairs, one male, one female, and the female co-chair is capable of effectively stopping the process at any given time. And for those of us who play with ideas of power, that means women have the power within these organizations and within these councils and communes, which is, I will tell you, that's a fundamental change from what Middle Eastern society is. Just as an example, you walk into any home in Syria, and there are two living rooms, one for men, one for women, right?
Wow.
So there's fundamental space difference, I mean, even at the level of social space in terms of where men and women sit. And then the other piece of it is that Bookchin was very hooked into the ecology. He kind of came out of the 50s, but in the 60s he became very ecologically minded. So ecology is a huge piece of it. And that resonates well with the Kurds. The Kurds are traditionally kind of located in the mountains, although they cover vast ranges of territory and vast types of territory too, everything from desert to high mountain. But mountains are considered kind of the homeland of the Kurds. They're the natural barrier that they've maintained between themselves and other, oppressive groups.
Just to pause you there for just a second, just for a little clarification, correct me if I'm wrong, but Kurdish people predominantly live in like southern part of Turkey. It'd be like the south eastern part of Turkey, northern part of Iraq, northeastern Syria, and a little bit into Iran. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's traditionally, I mean, if you kind of drew a large circle using, you know, kind of northern Iraq as a base, and you would cover much of what they understand Kurdistan to be.
Okay.
And, yeah, go ahead.
And so, in Iraq, there's also a Kurdish, what do you call region, of government, for lack of a better word. But they're quite a bit different than the Kurds that, in Rojava. Is that correct?
Right, the Kurdish regional government was basically the Bush administration, or the Bush family's second try at being able to split up Iraq into two separate sovereign nations so that they would be easier to deplete of their oil. So, you know, in Gulf War I, Dad Bush said basically to the Kurds, you rise up, we'll support you. Well, they rose up and the Americans didn't support them. In Gulf War II, Bush Jr. kind of said to the Kurds, you rise up and we'll support you. And they said, that's fine. The Kurds immediately proposed to oil companies exactly what concessions they would receive should the war be won. And, of course, the oil companies who ultimately controlled George Bush, you know, that was the right thing to do because then there was no way they could back out of it.
I see. I mean? Okay.
So it's run by effectively a family known as the Barzanis. It is extremely corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, the president of the Kurdish regional government, it's called the KRG. The Kurdish regional government just recently made a personal loan to a Swiss bank to keep them afloat, which, you know, I mean, who loans money to a Swiss bank, right?
Wow.
You know, so there's tons of money flowing through all of its oil. I spent a day or two in Erbil, which is the capital of the Kurdish regional government, and it's being built up and that type of thing. But, you know, again, it's an economy that's based on a single commodity, and when that commodity is completely extracted from the ground, it will return to from whence it came. And that's, so the KRG and the various authorities that are in North Rojava as well as in southern Turkey do not see eye to eye on much.
Okay.
The Rojavans and the southern Turkey folks, the PKK, the Kurdish Workers Party, the PYD, which is its sister party in Rojava, the Party for Democratic Development, they're anti-capitalist, they're anti-capital modernity, they're anti-state. And obviously when you're talking about Kurdish regional government, they're pro-state and pro-capitalist.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Yeah, they don't see eye to eye. What holds them together is, I think, fundamentally the ethnicity, although there's not a lot of love lost between those two.
Okay. So what I just found this out recently that I guess because I was wondering about what's going to happen here eventually with the I guess for the Rojavan Kurds who have had this, you know, this successful I hate to use the term, you know, but this form of self-governance, because there is governance. I mean, you know, you say they're against, but you know, you got these councils and everything else. So there's democracy and there, I guess it is a form of governance. I mean, unless you have a better term for it, but,
well, it's much more participatory.
Yes. Well, of course, but I mean, it's still,
but I mean, the fundamental idea of the nation state, which is, I mean, it's a really simple idea. It's contained in the idea of sovereignty. You know, Max Weber actually expressed this best, but it's an old one. It's from, you know, liberal thinkers like Locke, is the idea that one single agency or individual controls the monopoly of force over a geographic area. That does not characterize Rojava at all.
Okay.
There are numerous militias there. There are numerous authorities there. And, you know, that's not happenstance. Ocalan in his writing says, we're going to split up power in as many different ways as possible and drive barriers between it so it can't accumulate and overpower the people. Further, you know, one of the things that I saw, and this was one of the most interesting pieces of it, is a new militia has been brought about just recently, which is responsible to the local neighborhood blocks. It's called the HPC, the Heza Perestina Civitas. And these guys and women, they're all trained. They've got 17 days of training. They're all, you know, they have their Kalashnikovs. Their sole responsibility is not to any other authority but the local commune.
Interesting.
So, in other words, it would be like every block would have its own little army.
I see now the term confederation that you used. I mean, because that would be what you have in the sense that, since like this example you just giving now on this militia that's responsible just to their neighborhood, in order for everyone to cooperate and get along and actually even coordinate, you know, militarily against ISIL, let's say, that would require, you know, they're not at each other's throats, but obviously everyone's, you know, cooperating for a common purpose and that everything. So I guess that's where the term confederation, I think, really describes it, to me anyway.
Right, and coordination is hashed out in the context of the different commune councils, the executive council. And again, government is not what we take it. So each one of the, there is no federal government in Rojava. There are three separate governments operating, or three separate authorities operating in tandem with each other. The Canton, Jazeera Canton, which the capital is Kamishli, Kabani Canton is the capital is obviously Kabani, and then Efrin Canton, which is over in the northwest, which is currently cut off by ISIS, but they're hoping to break through and at some point in time. And so each one of these have their own separate, you know, identities, organizations, that type of thing. But the interesting thing is that their legislatures, which are chosen not by vote at this point in time, but are chosen kind of like the communes will propose people, and the different communes will kind of hash out who they want to send. Each one of the political parties, and there are a ton of political parties there. Again, we're not talking about a one-party state. We're talking about multiple parties. Muslim Brotherhood is there. There's a number of Islamist, Arabist parties, Christian parties, Yazidi parties that are taking part in it. And then there's interested individuals will also sit in the legislature as well. I sat with the Kabani Canton legislative minister. This is the guy who runs the legislature. And I said, so what do you guys do, actually? And he said, well, when the communes propose something and they start acting on it, because communes don't have to ask permission of anybody, we take what they do and make it legal. And then we tell everybody else about what we've done. Oh. So basically, the legislature functions as a communicatory body to all the other communes and councils. And it also, you know, like the HPC, the militia that I saw, that wasn't a function of government. That was a local initiative. We need militias to protect ourselves. Let's get some Kalashnikovs and arm some of our women and men. And they said that to the legislature, okay, so we've done this. Can you make it legal? And they came back and said, yeah, we'll make it legal. Do you need a name? Would you like a uniform? You know, what else can we help you with?
You don't,
and that's exactly what happened.
I'll tell you what, this is what's really interesting about this because, you know, even though, you know, it's hard to wrap your head around this if you're used to, you know, most of us out here are used to, what we've been having, what we've considered to be, you know, government, governance, you know, and so-called democracy, you know, varying in various degrees.
Well, Dave, yes. I think we have a situation right here at this radio station, you know, of self-governance of people, and there's going to be some disagreements coming up, and this thing is, stuff has happened in the past, and I hope we can avoid it this time, but that's just the way it is.
Well, okay, you know, I know, but I'm just saying that for most people,
it's frustrating and hard.
Yeah, yeah. Man. For a whole region that's kind of like their own autonomous region. I mean, this is just
imagine what it's going to be if we can't, if we, you know, we have a hard time in our own organizations, you know, as people, you know, unions and everything else.
That
are supposed to be self organized democracies.
Right, but you know, you consider, that's a good point, Bill. And then you have, you know, here in this case with Rojava in the air, in the region of the world it's in, it's been having so much turmoil, and you got all these different ethnic and religious groups together, all armed to the teeth.
Well, I mean, people who have been fighting and dying and killing.
This is the amazing thing about this, you know, I mean, this is just incredible. And I just found out
just as a contretemps to it. So, I mean, one of the most hierarchical organizations that we know historically is the Army, right?
In yes,
other words,
right.
The military forces, things like that. So I spent a number of days with the YPG. YPG is Yekenin Perestina Jel, and YPJ is the Yekenin Perestina Jin, which are the men's and women's militias. And
okay.
These are the guys who are, even now as we speak, they've just pushed into eastern Syria, so they're doing some great work and are an incredible military. This is a military that's a militia, not an army. So right now, if I were to walk into a Kamishli YPG post, there would be no officers there at all. There would be not a single salute thrown, not a single person jumping off a couch when an officer comes into the room. That's not what they do. Before a battle, they will elect leaders. The leaders will be chosen on the basis of what they know about the regional area, who they know within the regional area, maybe command skills, that type of thing. Those individuals will command, you know, any one of the given units of the YPG, and they have several different permutations, you know, fire teams, blocks, suites, that type of thing. And then when the battle ends, everybody goes back to being a militiaman or a militiawoman.
That's quite incredible.
There is no hierarchy as we know it within this militia body. And it blows the Americans' minds. They still don't get it.
Yeah.
The one thing that really bugs them is that they think that this should be a really inefficient force. And they blew that to hell when, you know, the YPG and the YPJ punched a hole through to Shingar Mountain and rescued 50,000 Yazidis stuck without food or water on top of a mountaintop, and they punched through 75 miles of ISIS lines. It took them exactly 36 hours to come up with those plans. When asked, you know, the Pentagon was asked, how long would it take you? They said at least 6 months to a year to make those plans. YPG didn't even think about it. They organized themselves, they elected leaders, and they went forward, and they did it.
That's pretty incredible. Yes, I remember hearing that story, and this was kind of about the same time that this started becoming more public as far as this unique, autonomy region, if you will. One thing I just found out recently, though, is I was kind of wondering what's going to happen eventually, you know, with Rojava. Sure. And I just found out the other day that I guess the Rojava Confederation is not opposing Assad, and that Assad has recognized them at this point, at least as an autonomous region. And the U.S. is not considering them terrorists like the Turkish government is, which is a U.S. ally and a NATO member. But yet they're anti-capitalist. So, I mean, this is going to be real interesting to see how this plays out and how it's going to affect Rojava here in the coming years.
Right, and they don't have first of all, it's kind of a different scenario with Turkey. Turkey, the PKK, which is the Kurdish Workers' Party, is considered terrorist by the U.S., but the PYD, which is kind of the sister of the PKK in Rojava, is not. So you can go figure that out. And then YPG and YPJ, the two militias, are not considered, as a matter of fact, State Department came out on September 12th of this year and said YPG, YPJ, not terrorist organizations, specifically so they could start handing them arms without having to go to anybody and tell them about it. So, right now, just as I was there, there were a lot of things happening. And actually, when I was there, it's kind of the opposite of that. I think that there has been some waffling now with the Russian thing. But when I was there, every YPG commander that I spoke to, and most of the political folks as well, said, Assad's got to go. We've got to destroy the regime and bring about what they call free democratic Syria, which is the flag that they're fighting under now in terms of a flag. But, you know, their attitude, at least the Kurds in the north, and well, the Rojava various cantonal authorities, is we just want to be left alone.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, they recognize the fact that they can't act as a sovereign power, and again, this reflects back on them. They know they're not a nation state. They can't print money. They can't engage in international treaties. That's why, like in Komishla, which is the capital of Jazeera Canton, there's an international airport. Well, they didn't want to run that because that implies that they immediately have international treaties,
yeah.
Right? So they let the Syrians stay, and it's like, you guys run this because, you know, we don't want to be involved in all that nasty sovereign stuff, and if we need to come in and take it over or use it, we will.
That reminds me of the early IWW who didn't want to have contracts. It's just that something happened, they just wanted to take care of it.
That's exactly. An interesting analogy. And they also, you know, there's a post office there that's run by the Syrians as well, because of course post offices imply at least some type of international treaties to be able to pass mail. So if you need to mail something right now from Rojava, you either got to sneak it across the border into Turkey, or you have to be able to get it to Komishli so it can be shipped out internationally. Mm-hmm. Locally, it's not a problem, but you know, when you go internationally, you have some issues there. So again, they're being real sticklers and doing the best that they possibly can, but they still use the Syrian pound. And, you know, with a free democratic Syria, they'd obviously be using that money and things like that. And again, that buys them out of a lot of stuff, because they recognize if they started printing their own money, it would put them in the way of banks to manipulate that money, right? And they're also real clear that, you know, the money and the weapons are receiving from the U.S. The U.S. is going to come in and ask them to pay the piper at some point in time.
Yes.
So they've been real skittish about constructing long-term relationships with the U.S. for very good reasons, because they don't want to become a KRG.
Yes, yes.
Right. They want to be able to use that oil to build their own infrastructure, and not to build the infrastructure in New York and London and Tokyo. So, I mean, they're real clear about it. We didn't really hear a lot about the revolution, but I will tell you this, that, you know, from an anarchist perspective, my thought goes back to Ukraine 1921 or Spain 1936. And in Spain, when the communists took over, there was a push to, we've got to win the war and then we'll fight the revolution. And the Kurds know their history. They know their anarchist history real well, where they're saying, no, the war and the revolution resonate with each other. Power is drawn from both reciprocally, and we have to push both forward as rapidly as possible. And that concept produces an organization called Tevdem, which is literally the movement for democracy. And Tevdem is responsible for implementing democratic confederalism within the Rojava area. Now this, if you want to look for power and you want to look for people who are playing with power, this is the organization, not a government agency, a group of, again, a confederation of all these different political parties who are pushing power as rapidly as possible in the form of initiative, in the form of resource, in the form of being able to make decisions into the community as rapidly as possible. They want as much power as present. The legislature's relationship to the commune is very interesting. The legislature cannot right now initiate any legislation. It's not their ability. The minister of each one of the different cantons as a prime minister cannot initiate legislation. Only communes, only local initiatives can initiate legislation.
This is just amazing. And, you know, Paul, we'd love to, you know, we're about out of time here. And, I'm kind of glad it didn't work out last week because, you know, we got today because we did kind of a special program here, extended our time. You had more time to explain this because this is pretty, interesting and complex stuff, you know, for people to, you know, really understand what's going on. And we've just scratched the surface, I'm sure. So we'd love at some point down the road here in a couple, you know, 2-3 months or whatever, if you'd be willing to do a follow up on kind of what's, you know, happened and stuff, because, you know, who knows what's going to happen in Syria in the next, you know, even few months, much less the year.
Let me just, I brought back some messages from the Rojavan revolutionaries, and they asked me to ask a couple of things to the American audience.
Okay.
I promised them that.
Absolutely. Yes.
So here it is. One, anything that can be done to alienate, to box the Turkish state needs to be done.
Okay, because they've been bombed by the Turkish military here.
It's actually worse than that. The border between Rojava and Turkey is sealed, locked tight. They cannot get reconstruction supplies, medicines, technicians across that border to save their lives. And that's one of the reasons Kobani, if you've seen my photos on the internet, Kobani is still looks like it did after the siege 13 months ago, 14 months ago. So to alienate the Turkish state is really important. Second, individuals who are technicians, electrical, chemical, sanitation engineers, computer geeks, artists, writers, that type of thing. Anybody who wants to participate in this revolution or learn about it, go to Rojava. If you're interested, go to therojavaplan.com. Talk to those guys. They're the ones who snuck me into Rojava initially. They will get you in there. And if you want to participate in a revolution, a living revolution that really has a chance to change capitalism fundamentally, this is it. It may not come again in your lifetime.
Wow, that's really powerful, and I'm glad you were able to get that in, Bill.
New Lincoln Brigade.
The new Abraham Lincoln Brigade, yeah. Okay.
They've had this, the foreign fighters they've had for years, but now they need people to come in and not fight the war, but build the revolution. This is where the rubber hits the road.
These are foreign fighters we can get behind.
Right, exactly.
Yes.
These are guys, even though some of them are not the most politically enlightened, as a matter of fact, some are like special forces who just want to kill a lot of Daesh people. It's like, whatever, go ahead. You know, a lot of them that I spoke to said, you know, I came over here to kill Daesh, and I found myself in the midst of a revolution that taught me about democracy.
Wow, that's pretty powerful. That's great. Well, Paul, thank you so much for calling in. And like I said, here in a few months or so, we'll have to get you back on if your busy schedule allows it.
Sure. Just one quick thing. Email address is paul@calpress.org. paul@calpress.org. Just, you know, and CalPress is just one word. If people have questions or are interested in me presenting that type of thing, please get in contact with me. Again, I came back from Rojava, and I was told fight the revolution in the U.S., and that's what I'm doing.
The belly of the beast.
Okay. All right, Paul, again, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye. Wow, Bill, that was quite a lot of information there and stuff.
Well, I mean, see, that's one of the hard things to do when you're interested in anarchism is to find anything, even literary mentions of anarchism, like a book like The Dispossessed by Ursula Le Guin, K. Le Guin, and it's definitely real difficult to find actual living examples of anarchism in practice.
But isn't anarchism, doesn't that mean chaos and violence and destruction and the end of the world Armageddon? Because that's what the corporate media always associates with the word.
Yes, yeah. Well, anarchy is part of the definition, unfortunately.
Well,
anarchism is an ideology,
yeah,
and it does not disallow organization at all.
Yeah, anarchy is really it's a misuse of the term. Really, they were inserting that to mean chaos,
yeah,
which is not the same thing.
Yeah, well, anarchy is basically a state of not having a state, I guess.
Well, the concept in itself is kind of difficult for, you know, most people to wrap their minds around, considering, you know, what we've been used to in our life, you know, here. I'm not just talking about here in the U.S., but, you know, worldwide, you know, at least in the Western world and worldwide for that matter. Yeah. And, so yeah, this is, you know, Paul Simons, you know, not just the information about what's going on there in the northeastern Syria with the Rahab and Serbs, but just this whole, all this stuff that they've been doing as far as, I mean, this is revolutionary, I guess would be a good word for it. I mean, just, it's very unique. I mean, well, you know, Dave, for lack of a better word.
There's been kind of a theme today on WEFT that's going to continue probably, with the Vision 2020 show also. And, at least on Paul Muth's show earlier, News from Neptune, he played a piece by Carl Dixon, which really got into
from Black Agenda Report.
From Black Agenda Report, mm-hmm. which was really getting into how we had split up into single issue things, and also how that had developed in ways that really hurt us in even getting that issue taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's due to the way, different ways you organize, getting grants, organizations, mm-hmm. and things like that. And, we've had that here. We're talking about Rojava and people being able to get together on the basis of something besides money,
mm-hmm.
and power, just to do the good thing and be free.
And that would benefit everybody in the
right.
long run.
Right. And mm-hmm. they're successful at it. And we have WEFT, which I have always wanted to show as an example of people getting together and doing things and doing something that really takes a lot of organization. I mean, running a radio station is a very complicated thing, and that we do it not for money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe some of us have some reasons for doing it that aren't so great, but at least we're not doing it for money.
Yeah.
But it really makes things difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have to do other things for money.
Yeah.
Indeed. And, there's also, you know, it's a carrot and a stick that's not there,
mm-hmm.
you know, in
yes.
regards to getting things done here.
Okay, Bill, well, thank you for sharing that with us and everything. So yes, tune in at here at 1 o'clock, with Sandra Alton and Chris Evans, and you can hear some more of this issue specifically about the WFT, community radio station, which, believe me, I mean, you know, community radio stations are a very important asset, all around the country.
Yeah. I mean, look what we were talking about today. Were you going to hear that? You're not going to hear that on the satellite.
Yeah.
You might be able to find this type of discussion somewhere like radioforall.net.
Yeah.
Okay, but you're not going to find it anywhere over any airwaves.
Yes. And that's what's unique about our station. Corporate free, and that's also part of the challenge.
Send us money. Send us money.
But you said it wasn't about money, Bill.
But we need it, because we're swimming in a sea of capitalism here, folks.
Yes, and you need a life vest.
Upstream.
Yes.
Really steep upstream, too.
Yes.
I mean, it makes salmon look like it's easy.
Okay. All right. On that note, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on listener supported community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. And until next week, be safe and power the people. Take care.